Hello everyone, this is Nelson for VideoGamesInTheBible.com and another Christian Games Done Right interview. And today I'm speaking with Ryan Vandendick of Eden Industries about his career as a game developer who is a Christian and his most recent project, Citizens of Earth, which is a really quirky, Earthbound-like RPG that I ended up falling in love with over the past few months. So, hello Ryan.
Hello, yeah, thanks for having me here.
So, how did you get into gaming in the first place? Did you come into it as a gamer or someone just interested in computers?
Yeah, definitely came into it as a gamer. So, when I was really young, I mean, I was in love with, like, you know, my original Nintendo, my Intellivision, for anyone who's old enough to know that one. And, you know, my mom, you know, she would buy me games and things like that. And it was kind of funny because it got to the point where she would buy me a game and I beat it so fast that it was almost, like, exasperating for her. I remember a couple of examples where, actually, since this is a, you know, we're talking about, you know, Christian-type stuff here, too. There was a game on the original Nintendo called Spiritual Warfare, which is a Christian game. And it's, I think, a really good example of a Christian game. I think it's actually still fun even today. But anyway, I remember, like, beating it really fast. My mom was like, that game was supposed to last for a year. And I don't know what game is supposed to last you a year, but there's that. And then one Christmas, she got me Aladdin on the Super Nintendo. And I beat it, like, that weekend. And she was, like, so, like, sad for me because she felt like, oh, I need to go buy you another gift. Like, I her gift wasn't any good. But I was like, no, it was a fine game. It's just I beat it. And
just imagining you in a top hat and monocle, like, no, mother, it was a fine experience, you know. Just,
yeah.
It ran its course.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And it got to the point where one time, I remember very clearly, so I was at school, and my mom used to help out with school and stuff like that and volunteer. And so she was helping out the class, and it was like the computer time for the class, whatever. And I guess maybe I was playing a game or whatever it was in the class, and my mom said, you know, you beat these games so fast, you should just make them for a living. And I was 8 years old, and I remember thinking, that's a good idea. And really, since then, that was it. I was like, yep, I'm going to make games. Since my mom said that at 8 years old, and that was pretty much it. I just, the rest of my, you know, I guess at that point, elementary school, middle school, high school, that was it. That was my path. When you went to university to do computer science, all with sort of the goal of making games, and yeah, trajectory of life was set.
From that initial comment, you kind of just looked at what would be the next steps along the line, like, okay, I need to go into computer science and do this and this and this to realize that dream.
Absolutely. It was just like, let's tick off the boxes to get to that goal and just very kind of, I don't know, like, tunnel vision, like, that's the goal. I mean, I'm going to do what it takes to get there. Let's do it.
Was there ever a time when you felt like you wouldn't be in gaming or that you've even thought about leaving it? Because, honestly, whether you're playing or making them, sometimes just the tone of the industry or just the games coming out, maybe you're not feeling it, or it can just be exasperating or tiring.
Making games can be very tiring. Like, it takes a lot out of you, especially, like, when you're nearing release. I mean, working on Citizens of Earth, and this is not unique, but on Citizens of Earth, you know, I was working 100 hours a week for a long time. And, you know, that's sort of typical with almost everything I've ever worked on in the games industry. But, you know what, I don't think I've ever really thought of leaving. You know, when I sort of think of, like, well, what else would I do? I mean, there's other, you know, things I think I could do. But the thing that always comes down to me is, like, you know, when I used to work at other, you know, game companies, I would still come home at nights and make games, right? When I was in, you know, university, you know, in the whatever summer vacation, well, I didn't really have summer vacation, but, you know, whatever, during breaks, I would make games. And what I realized is, like, no matter what I do in my life, I'm always going to be making games, so there's no point in, you know, doing anything else. Like, it's just sort of that realization, like, this is it.
This is my art.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm, like, I don't know, I mean, it's just the number one thing I'm passionate about. I like playing them, I like making them, and I mean, you know, it's funny to say, but, you know, I don't know, maybe God gave me that passion and ability for a reason. Hard to say, but who knows?
The development cycle, from what I hear, I mean, when you're working 100-hour weeks, you can't really power through the latest RPG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't, it's kind of funny that, yeah, the more I've been making games, the less I've been playing them, in a way, especially when I'm super busy, like, that's totally true. But there are still some times, like, so I try to fit games in, like, so for example, I like playing on my 3DS because, you know, when I'm out of the house, like, I can't work, I'll be playing my 3DS. You know, my wife says, hey, let's go, you know, watch a movie on TV or something. So, you know, if I'm on the couch in the living room, I can't really do work, so, you know, I'll play my 3DS or whatever. Even, like, I have, like, an elliptical in my basement, and while I'm running on it, I play my DS. which, I don't know, maybe counteracts some of the exercise portion, but the point being is, like, because, yeah, I'm very busy, I try to, like, squeeze in some games where I can, but, yeah, definitely my game playing has gone down, but I think, in a sense, it's because of the busyness, but in a sense, also, it's like, I just love making games, like, you know, so I think to myself, what do I want to do this evening? Should I sit down and play a game? In the back of my head, I'm like, you know, I really wanted to add that new gameplay feature of that new project I'm working on. Well, I'm just going to go do that. It's just fun for me. So I think that kind of just the fact that I love making it so much kind of takes away from some of the playing, which, I mean, I don't know, there's pros and cons of that, I suppose. But
do you find that playing games, though, is a valuable thing to do as a game creator?
Yes, but I think you have to approach it in a different way. So, for example, one thing is that it's not enough to just play good games, because sometimes you learn more from bad games, right? And so it is a different mindset. Like, if I'm looking for, you know, oh, okay, I only have, you know, a limited amount of time, I really want to play such and such a game, I mean, that's all well and good, and you do learn from that. But at the same time, you can't really necessarily limit yourself just to, like, you know, the games you really want to play, right? Like, there's learning to be had sort of across the spectrum. And so I think, in a sense, there is a bit of a different mindset that kind of goes into it. And again, you know, like, if I'm doing that for learning, I'll have my, you know, notes open, I'll be taking notes while I'm playing, and probably I won't play the game to completion, maybe, right? Because once you hit, like, a certain mark, I mean, you've sort of seen most of the high-level things you're going to see, so maybe they'll move on. And so I feel like there's a bit of a difference between playing a game for enjoyment and playing it for kind of, you know, learning, studying, research. But yeah, it is important to play for learning, for sure.
I've noticed a lot of game creators talk about taking notes while playing a game. When you're playing a game, what sort of notes do you take? And is that influenced by the project you're working on at the moment? Like, when you were working on Citizens of Earth, did you find yourself taking more RPG and system and energy-related notes than normal, or what you would if you were working on another project?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, for Citizens of Earth, you know, like, I've been taking notes on RPGs just for years. Like, it's a genre I just personally love. So when it came to, you know, Make Citizens, I already had pages and pages and pages of notes, plus just sort of a general sense of the things I liked and wanted to change and things like that, just from RPGs in general. But yeah, I mean, like, what happens is usually I'll be playing a game and something will, you know, come up like, oh, hey, you know, here's a new mechanic, try this type thing. I go, whoa, that was fun. I need to make a note about that. Or, you know, as I'm playing a bit, you know, I realize, like, I'll give you an example. So I was recently playing Final Fantasy XIII. A few years late to that party, but whatever. that's most of my gaming. It's many years late, right? Because I don't have time, the time to, you know, when it comes out. And then, you know, years later, it's $5 on Steam. So I'm like, well, I can't not pay this now. Right?
Yeah.
So I'm playing Final Fantasy XIII, which, I mean, is not an amazing game, all things considered. But it does some things really well, right? Like, you know, like, one thing is, you know, you get in and out of battle super fast. And so, like, it doesn't really feel like a big deal. Like, it doesn't feel like grinding. You're in and out. You know, at the end of the battle, you can put, like, you know, points to your thing, and you always feel like you're growing. And so, I mean, even though some people, you know, like, that said Final Fantasy XIII, not that great, blah, 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 I still think there's a ton to learn from it, even if sort of the whole was worse than the sum of its parts, if you know what I mean.
Actually, that's really cool, because if you're just a game player, when you play an awful game, you're just like, oh man, well, I guess I wasted that money. But as a game creator, you can still get valuable things even from a relatively terrible experience or one that's just uneven in some bits.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, as you know, it's a really great sort of exercise and discipline to learn to sort of, when you're playing a game and something doesn't work right, or, you know, like, oh, this isn't very fun or something, just sort of go through your head the process of, like, well, you know, why do you think it came about the way it is, and what were the reasons, and what could you have done differently, and, you know what I mean? Like, and it's I think a really kind of good exercise to sort of practice your design and your creation to sort of see what, you know, ways to drink. Sometimes if a game is just really good, sometimes it's harder to do that, because everything just kind of works, right? And you're like, oh, it's just kind of fun. But if something is wrong, you can be like, well, that's bad. Let me dissect it.
What was your first job in the game industry? Was it coming out of college, or was it someone that you met during college that also wanted to make video games? Did you come out of your computer science degree just immediately like, okay, I'm going to start a studio and take on the world and et cetera?
No, so actually, while I was in university, I just finished my third year, I think, of four. And so at my university, we had, like, a very strong, what they call, like, a co-op program. So we would do, like, one term at school and the next term working for some company, right? And so, yeah, I just finished my third year, and I got, you know, I applied and got accepted to a company in Vancouver here, like, where I live, called Next Level Games. And so at the time, their biggest thing was Mario Strikers on the GameCube. And they were working on a sequel for the Wii. So that was my first game job, is I joined them to do like some like UI programming on Mario Strikers Charged for the Wii, just as like a, it was supposed to be a 4-month co-op, like just sort of as a break from university, right? And then I ended up actually staying, they really liked me, and I liked them, so I ended up staying for a year working on Mario Strikers and then doing all of like the gameplay, like special abilities for Spider-Man, Friend or Foe, that they also made.
What did you find was the big difference coming out of hobby game making into actually working with a company and with a team to make something like Mario Strikers Charged?
Well, one of the kind of best things is, like, you know, when you're doing hobby stuff, like, it's all on you, like, everything. And so, you know, even things that you're not interested in, not good at, right? Whereas for, you know, Mario Strikers or Spider-Man, sorry, they just said, you know, do this one thing. You know, so on Mario Strikers, it was, you know, implement the UI. On Spider-Man, it was like, hey, you know, create all these cool special abilities. And that was it. I could just sort of hone in on that area, really focus in, and just kind of, you know, do the best job I could. And, you know, sort of trust everyone else to kind of do their part to, you know, to kind of make the game, you know, as whole. And that was really, really good, right? Because, again, you're focusing on a specialty, on something you like, not having to worry about every tiny piece of the entire thing like you'd have to do if you were just, you know, doing something kind of hobby-wise, right?
So when you were working on Mario Strikers Charged, your job was to work with the UI, which is something that when you're thinking of making games, at least personally, when I first started learning about the development of games, I just thought of it as, oh, cool, you make Master Chief throw grenades and blow up stuff. You don't really think of, oh, man, someone needed to make the grenade indicator and then the health and the shield and just every little bit of it had to be created. So UI is one thing that a lot of people don't think about, but is actually really important for a number of genres across the board. So can you tell me a little bit about your experience working with UI, both in your own games and on Strikers Charged?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, you know, kind of set it up very well and just saying, like, it's not something you really think about, but, you know, when you kind of, you know, stop to examine it, like, it is really important, because if the UI, you know, doesn't work or is confusing, that kind of wrecks probably most of the rest of the game.
UI standing for user interface, right?
Yeah, that's right. Because, yeah, like, if the information, you know, that's being displayed to you by the game, like I said, you know, is incorrect or is confusing, your whole interaction with the game is going to suffer. And so it's one of those things, they call it sort of a hygienic variable, right? Like, you only notice it when it's not there. Kind of like they say, you know, like someone brushing their teeth, you only notice when they stop doing it, you know what I mean? So you only notice UI when it's bad. If UI was good, you don't notice it. It's just in the background. It's just, you're just playing the game, right? And that's sort of the main goal of UI, is to sort of be out of the way, innocuous, just give you the information, let you play the game, and not feel like, oh, I'm navigating the menu, because then it sort of breaks that feeling of playing the game. Right now you're, you know, managing a menu, or you're, oh, this is so frustrating, I click over here, and click, you know what I mean? So it was, like you said, it's something that, you know, I had not given a lot of thought about before starting at the job, but it was a really good learning experience, just to kind of see that other side of the, you know, kind of the development, and, you know, learn just a new type of, I guess, you know, perspective, which is like developing features and systems that are meant to kind of stay as unintrusive and hidden as possible, as opposed to things more like, you know, gameplay and things like that, which are kind of like in your face, like, experience this, you know?
I've been playing a lot of classic games, so things like Baldur's Gate, they put everything on the screen, and it ended up feeling very jumbled.
Yeah.
And over time, you've seen that kind of stripped back, and features are stripped alongside that to try to make things more accessible. But is it possible to kind of streamline it so much as to where it becomes obtrusive again?
I think so. Like, so one example is, for most of the development of Citizens of Earth, we had what I thought was a pretty fun font in the game. And at a certain point, Atlas has said, look, I think especially as a problem on the smaller screens, Atlas is like, oh, I just don't think it's reading very well. It has some fun, you know, flourishes and serifs on the font, the whole thing. So we're like, okay, fine. For like the 3DS and Vita, we'll switch to another font that's just, you know, more like kind of readable and clear cut. And eventually they're just like, can you just do it on all the platforms and just make it read easier? And I'm like, okay. And like, I don't know. I mean, it's not something I, you know, fret about at night or anything, but it did seem like it lost a bit of the playfulness when you know, if you're reading dialogue and it has some, you know, kind of fun look to it. Because, you know, the game is sort of quirky and fun. It doesn't take itself too seriously. And I thought, you know, the font we had kind of reflected that. And now, you know, we had to change it to something that's a little more standard. But I think to your point, like, there is a possibility to make, you know, the UI kind of so streamlined it's obtrusive, in the sense where, again, so the point about UI, right, is it needs to feel like a seamless, hidden part of everything. And if you try to streamline to the point where it doesn't feel like it matches the rest of the game anymore, then it will become obtrusive again, right? Because you've sort of broken that, you know, kind of veil of hiding unobtrusive, like, you know, sitting behind the scenes. So I think there is a way to go too overboard with it, yeah, and then kind of destroy the unity it has with the rest of your game.
You worked at Next Level Games for a year on Striker's Charge and then Friend or Foe.
Yeah.
What was your next job after that?
So my next job, yeah. So then I went back to finish university. Like I mentioned, you know, I was still in university at the time. So I went back, finished university, and then I ended up working. Actually, I was supposed to go back for 3 terms to finish my degree. I ended up going back for 1, realizing, like, I can't take this anymore. I need to get back to work. I wanted to come back to Next Level and sort of finish my remaining 2 terms, like, just distance ed. But they didn't, like, sort of have a position I was interested in. So I ended up working at Silicon Knights. This time I was actually doing a game designer rather than a programmer.
Oh, Silicon Knights of Two Human Eternal Darkness.
That's right. And, yeah, so I worked for them for about 1.5 years. And, yeah, just sort of finished up my degree in the first 8 months of that. And, yeah, I was working, like I said, as a game designer there. Because, you know, I'm passionate both in design games and programming. I like both. So I wanted to try something different so that they were kind enough to let me be hired as a game designer, which is rare because, for whatever reason, most companies, when they hire game designers, they will hire people with, like, an art background or a QA background or a production background, very rarely a programming background. So they were very, very nice to hire me for that.
What's one of the really interesting low-level design decisions you ended up making, or at least thinking about during your tenure with Silicon Knights?
Well, so we were working on a game, and it never got released, but I could probably talk about it. I don't know. I think Silicon Knights is, like, defunct now, I think I could probably talk about most things. But we were working on a game. It was not released, but the character you play was, like, a doctor. Like, you're a 40-year-old, you know, middle-aged, unassuming, I don't know, surgeon, doctor, so some medical doctor, right? But yet, in the game, I mean, you had to fight. And so there was sort of a sense of, like, okay, well, what would a 40-year-old paunchy doctor fight like?
I assume this doctor was not Dr. Gordon Freeman.
Correct. That's right. And, you know, so that, you know, kind of was a prevailing, you know, sense of, like, well, yeah, what would this guy do? I mean, he's not going to do, like, you know, crazy, like, you know, because you have weapons if you can pick up, like, a machete and things like that, right? So you're not going to do, like, you know, crazy, like, sword dancing combo attacks, right? Like, that's just not who the character is. So we had to figure out, like, well, what, you know, what's this guy going to do that's realistic but also fun? Because, you know, you don't want to play a character that's just lame, right? Can't do anything. So that was a struggle, like, just to kind of, yeah, figure out how you can make, you know, combat fun while standing, yeah, within the realm of realistic. And for us, yeah, realistic was not a soldier like Rainbow Six or any kind of, like, warrior or hero. It was just a middle-aged doctor. Right?
Actually, realism is an interesting topic because in the quest for realism, a lot of quote-unquote realistic things are cut, like, for this middle-aged doctor. I'm not thinking, like, you had a section where he argued with the barista over the price of his latte or something.
Well, we did have, like, there were some, it wasn't maybe quite that specific, but there were things where you would, like, argue with people in town, and you had a wife and a kid, and you would, you know, have arguments with them and things like that. And, I mean, in a sense, actually, that's one thing I really liked about the game, is that, you were playing a character, and sure, in combat, he didn't make a lot of sense. Why is a doctor wielding a machete? But then, you know, he goes back home, and, you know, his son is missing, and his wife is worried, and, you know, things like that, and you're having a, you know, an argument about it. And on the whole, it sounds like, you know, some sort of domestic dispute game. But the one thing it does, though, is it does make it more, again, realistic for the character. You believe it. Yeah, you are just a middle-aged doctor with a wife and a kid. This is probably something you would do, and it kind of ties into, again, the characterization of the story, probably better than, again, if you're, like, you know, you think of, I don't know, your average RPG or whatever, you know, JRPG or some, you know, I don't know, spiky-haired, prepubescent teen boy, you know, and anything that he does, I think there's a bit of, like, well, it's just a cartoon, you know, it's a type
suspension
thing.
Of disbelief.
Yeah, right, because, like, I don't know, like, you know, you kind of buy it. Fine, he's a prodigy swordsman, I guess, but then when it comes time to, like, oh, he's talking to, like, your other party members, the girl he likes, you're like, ah, come on. So it's just a bit weird. Like, it just doesn't fit anymore. I mean, you know, some people will like it, and that's all well and good, but this I just felt did something unique, which was, like, let's, you know, really try to show, like, this person is a human, is a real human character, and see what we can do with sort of the, I don't know, the emotional part of who this character is. And you know, and then, you know, so for example, your son goes missing. Well, you know, part of the thing in the game was like, well, what are you going to do to get him back? Like, who are you going to be? And it sort of had this aspect of, like, morality. And I think that is something people and, you know, especially parents probably can understand. Yeah, what would you do to get your kid back?
And this was right before, like, Heavy Rain and Telltale's The Walking mm-hmm. Dead and et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it never came out, so it's, I'm not going to say, oh, you know, we did it first or better or anything like that, but it did definitely have some very interesting kind of ideas like that kind of feeding it.
And it's very interesting, someone, like, on the outside, such as myself, I'm hearing that idea and I'm like, why wasn't this made? Projects are shuttered every day that we don't necessarily know about. Mm-hmm. And as a game creator yourself, have you ever regretted certain games not coming about? And when you started handling your own studio, how did you decide, okay, this is probably a project that it's about time to lay it to rest? It's cool, but we can't really do something lasting here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that game I was talking about, Silicon Knights, is probably the biggest one that I mean, in a sense, I really regret that it didn't come out because it had so much potential, but obviously it had enough problems, that's why it wasn't released. But certainly when I started my first day and saw this game, I was like, wow, this is really cool. Although, having said that, I will say, as a Christian, I was really conflicted with that game because, I mean, Silicon Knights, you know, Eternal Darkness was, like, you know, rated R or M or whatever it was, like, you know, and this game was going to be the same. And so it had some content that I thought was, I was uncomfortable with as a Christian. So, in a sense, it's like, well, maybe it's okay it didn't come out because, you know, I don't have to put sort of my name on that and be associated with it. But at the same time, I think it was really cool. But then, like, so for myself, like, one of the projects I'm working on right now that we're developing a prototype for is actually the first game a continuation of the first game I ever made. And I made this, you know, back in 2006, 2007 kind of thing. And, I mean, when I say game, really, so it's an RPG, and I made, like, the battle system, and that was it. I didn't want to even worry about the world or anything like that. So I made the battle system, and it was very fun. I liked it a lot. But at the time, I didn't have anywhere near the resources to make, like, an RPG. So I just said, okay, I can't do that yet. And it's hard, because, like I said, I love RPGs. Like, it's my favorite genre, but, man, they're hard to make. Like, just in terms of sheer content, they just have so much art, so many, like, areas, like, levels to explore. Typically, I mean, you could, you know, do something unique to not do that, but typically they do, right?
Especially for the ones that are recognized on a mainstream level, the cool little fun details, those take a lot of time and effort to...
Yeah. Yeah, and like, I mean, one of the things with Citizen's Birth, right, is like, you know, every enemy exists on the overworld, they walk around, they, you know, will sit there idling, and like, I mean, that was a ton of animation cost that many people don't really think about. Like, if we had just had random battles where enemies show up and do an attack, we would have saved, like, so much money. And so, you know, it's just one of those things that, like, well, we really wanted to do that, and it, you know, because Earthbound did it, and we were, you know, trying to kind of capture that same kind of vibe. But of course, when we have, like, I don't know how many enemies we had in the game, lots, 80, 100, something like that, that's a ton of work, right? So it just kind of adds up. But anyway, so yeah, I realized at the time, back in 2007, I didn't have the resources to finish an RPG, so I shelved it. When I was thinking of making sort of kind of starting my own studio and making games, I mean, yeah, I had a couple ideas. And again, they were sort of in that same boat. Like, what can I make? We had another prototype, and again, it kind of didn't go anywhere. Just didn't, again, at the time, didn't have kind of the resources to finish it. And then I started working on Waveform, and suddenly, here was a game I probably did have the resources to finish because its design was, I mean, extremely simple and just relied on sort of a preciseness of execution, which is something that I could sort of accomplish without, you know, a ton of extra people contributing art and all these things, right? And so that's sort of, I guess, yeah, why I went with that one. And, you know, now I'm, I guess, fortunate that I can sort of resurrect that old RPG idea and kind of bring it back. Since, yeah, I shelved a long time ago, and I always sort of regretted that I couldn't make it. So
after Silicon Knights, after your education through university and Next Level Games, what was next for you? Did you start the studio after that, or do you accrued more industry experience and gravitas, as it were, before you struck out on your own?
Well, what happened was, so one of the reasons I left Silicon Knights, so this is like June 2009 now, was I wanted to start making indie games. And basically, Silicon Knights wouldn't let me do it. So I don't know if you're aware, but there's a very standard contract, or a very standard clause in video game contracts that basically says anything you make, whether at work or at home, belongs to the company. And so if I were to make an indie game, legally, Silicon Knights would have owned it. And that did not sit well with me. So I asked like for permission, like, can you not do that? And they said no. And finally I said, like, well, I'm leaving then. And they're like, okay, well, maybe you can make a game, but you can't sell it for money. And I was like, no, it also didn't sit well with me. And at the time, so Next Level Games, I ended up going back to work at Next Level Games because they had been calling me quite a lot trying to get me to come back. And it always just kind of, I don't know, it's never really fit. But finally, I you know, they called me, or I called them, and I said, yeah, let's do it. So I moved, you know, back to work with them as a programmer again, a gameplay programmer. But I had it in my contract that I could make kind of indie games on the side, and that's sort of what I did for, I was working there for 2.5 years. And so I'd work there, and then evenings and weekends, whatever, I would come home and work on Waveform. And then at the end of 2011... I sort of let my contract expire. Like, I, you know, they wanted to renew it, but I said, no, I'm gonna leave. And spent the next 3 months kind of finishing Waveform to release it sort of early 2012 there. So, yeah, I kind of did both for the better part of 2.5 years, mainstream industry and indie.
So you are a Christian.
Yes.
When you were working at Next Level Games, for instance, you start looking at the demands of just game development in general. When you also add to that, you're building a family and your faith with Christ. How did you do that? Was it difficult?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, you know, you have to imagine, like, there are some times, I mean, I could go for a month or more where I basically wouldn't really see my wife, right? Because I, you know, she would work, like, she would get up, like, 5:30 for work, whatever it was. So I don't know, maybe say hi in the morning type thing. But then I go to work, and I wouldn't get home until, you know, midnight, 1 a.m., right? So she'd be long, you know, in bed by then. And of course, you know, then the next day, same thing. I don't know, maybe I'm conscious enough to say goodbye in the morning, maybe not, because I got home at 1 a.m. But I'm up again, off to work, and then, you know, again, come back late. So, and maybe I'm working, you know, 1 or 2 days on the weekend. So again, I, you know, I'm off to work, don't see her. So that's hard for sure. And also, yeah, hard for to manage faith. I mean, one thing I did was I rode my bike to work, so I would listen to, like, the Bible on, like, my phone, like the kind of audio Bible, and that at least let me have a bit of, I don't know, that sort of sense, like, I was still connecting with you know, faith-type stuff with God, even if, you know, I didn't have time, I guess, to sit down and do it, because I was always at work or to and from work or trying to get what little sleep I could. So that, I think, helped a bit. But it is really hard to kind of juggle all that. I mean, even putting aside trying to work on Waveform or anything, I mean, you could just, you know, just having one day job at a game company could still mean 80 hours a week at times, right? So, you know, forget trying to make another game. It can be very demanding, especially, you know, when there's deadlines and stuff, right?
How did you initially come to faith? Was it your parents or...?
Yeah, it was my mom. Again, so my dad, wasn't and also isn't Christian, but my mom wasn't, you know, she would, you know, bring us to church and...
So in other words, you know, not a magical adventure.
No magical adventure. But again, I mean, actually, you know, I'm very thankful to my mom. My mom has passed away now, but I'm very thankful to her. You know, she not only sort of, I guess, you know, brought me up in, you know, a sort of Christian household, I guess, or, you know, taught me those kind of things. But also, like I mentioned, encouraged me to, like, make games. So, you know, in a sense, like, a lot of my life is I owe to my mom. So, yeah, I'm very thankful to her. And so ever since I was a kid, my mom, you know, would, you know, I don't really, there's no real conscious memory of sort of not being a Christian. I mean, ever since I was old enough to read, you know, I had been reading the Bible and going to church and, you know what I mean? So that was, and then, but I will say, though, that, like, as people are prone to do in their adolescence, I sort of strayed a bit in a sense. Like, I still, you know, I still called myself a Christian, I guess, but it just wasn't that important to me. It wasn't like a priority.
So at what point did it solidify that this is my faith, this is my personal relationship with Christ?
So what happened was, for a high school graduation present, my mom got me a new Bible. And at the time, I was like, ah, mom, what a lame present, right? I wasn't so like, cool. But I was like, hey, whatever. So I packed it with me when I went off to university. So, you know, like, so I used to live, you know, on sort of the Western Canada. So I was going to like Eastern Canada for university. It's like 5,000 kilometers away. And so I didn't know anybody, right? Like, and I'm way too far to ever, you know, come home on the weekend type thing, right? So I didn't know anybody. I was there all alone. And for the first, at least first week, maybe even longer, first 3 weeks possibly, of university, the internet in my dorm was down.
Oh, God.
And so I did not... So I didn't know anybody. I couldn't, like, you know, even talk to people, like, you know, on MSN or whatever I was using back then, right? Couldn't email anyone. Like, I literally could not contact... I mean, I could phone my family. That was, you know, pretty much it, right? But I couldn't, you know, do the, you know, chat with friends type thing, right? So I, like, and I couldn't, you know, again, I couldn't do the standard distractions of, oh, I'll go online, do this and that, like, nothing. So there was literally nothing to do. I didn't know anybody. And so, but I had the Bible that my mom gave me. And I was like, well, I'll just read this. And honestly, I mean, it's, again, you know, to think back on it, it's a pretty, like, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to bandy about the term miraculous, but it's a pretty interesting culmination of events to, you know, have, you know, move out there, my mom gave me a Bible, the internet's down, to make me sit down for an extended period of time and really read the Bible. And one thing that really struck me was I was reading about, you know, King David and his Psalms, and also sort of the description of, you know, his life elsewhere in the Bible. And, you know, it describes David as a man after God's own heart. And I was like, wow, like, that is a very powerful descriptor and something that could not be said of me, but something that I want to be said of me.
Especially considering the man's life and the mistakes he made, the fact that he's still called after God's own heart, that's something really special.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very good thing to remember, too, right? It's like, he wasn't perfect. He messed up a lot. And so that really struck me. So I remember I was laying in you know, in my bed in my dorm reading the Bible, and it just really struck me. I just prayed, like, God, that's who I want to be. I want to be like that. That's who I want to be known for, to be kind of recognized as a man after God's own heart. And I think that was sort of when I really decided, like, I need to take this seriously, and I need to really, you know, be this kind of person that I'm saying I want to be. And so that's, I think, when it became much more personal for me.
When you started working in the game industry, obviously, sometimes as a result of your job, you're going to be working on projects or other elements of different things that you may not feel comfortable with, especially if you don't have your own studio or you're working for an employer. So how did you deal with those conflicts personally or emotionally?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, so Siliconites is probably the big example of when it was tough. I mean, Next Level makes, you know, they don't really make games that are too, I don't know, offensive, controversial, right? It's Mario, you know what I mean? So that was, you know, much easier to work on. Mario, Spider-Man, like, you know, it's pretty easy to, or it's not really any, you know, deep moral conflict there, right? But Siliconites was hard. I mean, and I, you know, to be honest, I don't even know that I really have the sort of the answer with what I could have done, should have done. I know that it was sort of weighing on me, and I think that's sort of, I don't know, one of the reasons perhaps I left, because I just didn't want to be associated with that kind of thing. It was meant to be scary and gory and, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, like, that was the whole point of it. So, you know, if I said, hey, we should maybe cut that out, they'd be like, well, there's no point making the game. Like, that was a pillar of the game, right? But I know, like, so, but for my part, I mean, whenever I was designing something, I would, you know, design things that I personally was morally comfortable with, you know, and so, you know, whatever it was, right, like, I would just inject my values into that. I didn't want to be designing things that I would be, you know, embarrassed for my family to play type thing, you know what I mean, for Christians to play. And I don't know, it's probably a very minor, like, action. I mean, you know what I mean, like, the game is still what it was going to be, like, my little morality injections here and there weren't, you know, going to make a difference, I think. So, I don't know. In the end, I don't know really what I could have done, should have done differently, but I do know that it kind of weighed on me. And I think that was one of the reasons why I wanted to make my own company, because I realized I don't want to be in that situation again where I'm not comfortable with something I'm working on. I want to make things that I am number one, comfort working on. Number two, comfort with everyone playing. Like, it's important to me that kids can play my games, because I play games as a kid, and I don't want to make games that are, like, just, you know, for mature, like, adults, like, rated R type thing.
Yeah.
And then three, like, games that, you know, I could play with God and not be embarrassed about, you know what I mean? if that were to ever happen.
Yo,
so,
Jesus, check this headshot!
So, yeah, that's one. I think one of the reasons that I made my own company is because I just wanted to make sure I could do those three things, which is not really able to guarantee that when you're working for someone else, right?
You released Waveform in 2012, or 2012 if you prefer. So, how have you seen the game industry change since then, and how have you adapted continuing to make other games?
Well, one thing is Steam, in particular, has become saturated now. And then it wasn't. Now it's crazy. Like, I had some friends that released a game on Steam a couple months ago, whatever it was. And there are so many games released that day, they weren't even on the new release page. And it just goes to show, like, it's tough, right? And so one of the things we've done to adapt is to expand to consoles. And, you know, thankfully we had, you know, sort of Atlas's sort of funding to help us. Because, I mean, you know, even, like, buying development kits is not cheap. There are multiple thousands of dollars per kit.
Wait, what is a development kit?
Oh, so basically, if you want to develop a game on a console, like, you can't really compile it on your computer. Like, you can't run it, you know what I mean? Like, you need that hardware to run it and to play it. So it's a basically a, I don't know, usually a box in shape that has kind of the guts of the actual console inside, plus, you know, some extra kind of developer debugging kind of hardware built in. $3,000 type thing.
Wow.
For a kit. So, you know, we released Citizens on four platforms, and we had, you know, we had two programmers. So, I mean, I don't know, what is it, like $25,000 just for the development kits? Like, it's not cheap, right? So, yeah, as I said, so thankfully, you know, Atlas had some funding help to press to acquire all those things. but that was one of the things we wanted to do, is sort of, you know, say, well, look, Steam is just too saturated. It's hard to stand out there. Let's kind of go on consoles where there's a much smaller kind of crowd vying for that space, right? Especially, actually, one thing that we have that's sort of, I guess, a special uniqueness is, you know, there are very few games that come out for, like, handhelds and, like, home consoles, right? Like, you know, we had the game on PS4 all the way down to 3DS, which is a huge difference in performance and, like, display size, screen size, right? But I think, like, you mentioned about, or I guess, maybe, I think you're saying this before we started the call, but if you can shrink the game down on even a PC, and it still looks good. So that, because we're making high-resolution 2D art, we're able to have it across all platforms. And because we wrote our own engine, we can have it work on all these platforms. So you think of something like Unity. Unity doesn't work on 3DS. You know? So the fact that we can just target any platform we want
means you can have it scale up or down, or basically you can, in granular detail, make sure everything works the way you need it to.
Yeah, and also hit any platform we want it to. Which, as I said, for purposes of, you know, market, you know, saturation, can be a very important point. Like, Atlas was very, like, they felt it was very important that the game release on 3DS. So again, if we were using any other commercially available engine, that would not have happened. We may not have had a contract with them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's a very important detail, you know, sort of for us. So, yeah, kind of related to your comment of, like, what are you doing to adapt to a changing market? That's one of the things we're doing, is sort of making sure that we can hit a lot of platforms and sort of get that sort of market penetration into a numerous sort of segments.
And now we reach Citizens of Earth, the second game to be released by your studio, Eden Industries, which is quite a nice name for a game studio, by the way.
Thank you, yeah. I like it.
Yeah, I wonder where Eden Industries comes from.
Actually, well, it's funny, I have a little blurb on our website about it, but one thing I really liked was the idea of, like, combining, like, I had a, so when I was coming up with the name, or just even my own sort of thoughts on the game development industry or whatever, you know, I really like games on, like, the original Nintendo and Super Nintendo. Like, they just have that kind of purity of play.
Yeah.
You just press start and you're playing the game. And I just love it. And it just has that, like, they couldn't rely on fancy graphics and things like that. So they're just like, look, you only got A and B, like, you know, in Mario. Let's just make everything we can do with A and B awesome, right? And I just love that kind of just pure gameplay. But of course, you know, modern games have a lot of really cool things, right? Like, you can get achievements and track them and compare them with your friends. And of course, yeah, you got fancy audio and visual bells and whistles. And
you've got and more kind of, than two buttons on the face.
Well, exactly, right? And so the idea between Eden and Jesus, Eden obviously, you know, sort of referencing sort of my own faith background, but also the idea of combining sort of a, you know, pure beginning with modern advancement. And so that was why I had Eden Industries.
Sweet. I did not know that. I just thought he mixed Eden with the company. Clever.
No, there was some thought. Yeah.
So yeah, your second game, which is actually one of my favorite JRPGs, it was one of the ones that got me to think, man, this genre isn't so bad. It isn't all just spiky-haired, prepubescent men. Citizens of Earth.
Yes.
You had a publisher with this game, Atlas. You released Citizens of Earth earlier in January. It had some issues at launch that you had to rush and try to patch and fix. Can you tell me a little bit about what happened there and how that worked?
Sure. I mean, so one of the things with working with a publisher is you don't always get to decide everything you want. So for reasons of, you know, scheduling and their shareholders, they had a very specific time they wanted to release Citizens of Earth. Now, it was actually pushed back a bit based on their original ideas. Now, I personally would have liked to delay it a bit more and fix some of the issues, but the thing is like, you know, I mean, we didn't knowingly ship a game, of course, with issues in it, right? Like, everything we knew about, we fixed.
But once you get into people's hands, like...
Yeah, once it's in the wild, it's a whole other thing. And, I mean, the thing that I think, you know, people may not know, too, is, like, you know, Sony and Nintendo, they test the game. And if the game crashes or has problems, they will not let you release it.
Really?
Yes. And we went through their certification. And remember, it was certified 8 times, right? Because there's 4 platforms, 2 regions, North America and Europe. So it went through Sony and Nintendo certification 4 times each, essentially, right? 2 platforms, 2 regions each. And they said, yeah, it's fine. It's ready for release. So they all said they had no problem with it. I mean, like, you know, they did catch up early on. They reported it. We fixed it. We resubmitted it. They're like, yeah, you're fine. You're good to go. So they played through their internal testing and said, no problem, right? We played it. I played through the whole game start to finish many times, no problem. Atlas's QA played through the game, start to finish many times, no problem.
But as an RPG, you have so many factors.
Oh, yeah. Like, the combinations are endless. And so, you know, I mean, yes, things came up that we had to fix. And, you know, yeah, I wish it would have been better. But, I mean, again, you know, I think there are certain things that happen during development that, again, I don't know. I don't really want to go into too many details about that just because I don't want to point fingers at who, you know, this versus fault, this
Absolutely.
Versus fault. I don't think it's going to help anything, but I mean, suffice to say, you know, it was, we learned some things from it, and I think we were resolved to do things a bit differently in the future. But again, you know, having a publisher just makes things hard because they sometimes just have requirements. Like, you know, I've shipped many games. I mean, even while at Next Level, you know, we released, you know, I worked on Spider-Man, I was there, Ghost Recon, and if you look at the reviews of those games, they're pretty bad. And partly it was because the publisher just said, this game is coming out at this date, I don't care, right? And it's just like, well, sometimes you can only do so much when there's like that kind of deadline, right?
Are there benefits for having a publisher, such as, you know, funding and et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, and again, my point, you know, always does not be like, oh, publishers suck. No, definitely not. I'm very thankful, you know, to Atlas for coming in to, yeah, help us not only with funding, but with, you know, marketing. For example, at E3, we had a booth. We were, like, right beside, right across the aisle from Smash Bros. Like, that was amazing.
Wow.
And so much fun. And, of course, that would have happened without, you know, Atlas being involved.
Being completely honest, did you sometimes sneak away from the booth to play Smash Bros.?
I actually, I never played anything while I was at E3. Because I, you know, I really wanted to, I mean, I was there for business, right? I wasn't there to have fun. So I stayed at the booth almost exclusively, unless I needed to go to the bathroom or something, because it was beneficial to me to watch people play, to talk to them while they play.
You got a lot of feedback that way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And sometimes it's not even feedback of what they say. You just watch what they do, and that's just a very valuable thing. And again, for me, I said it was a very fun opportunity to have my game, our game, you know, it's being collected for the team, at E3, And it wasn't an experience I wanted to sort of squander by just going off and playing other games, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, no, I stayed at the booth, and I talked to people pretty much the whole time. So, I say, yeah, I'm very thankful to Atlas for that. And, you know, it's like, you know, in a way, it's like a marriage, sort of, right? Like, being married is great. It's not all good, right? There are problems. There are things that you can't do anymore that you could when you were single, right? So, in a way, it's very similar, right? Like, you know, I said, it comes with a lot of benefits. But, yeah, there were, I couldn't make all the decisions on my own. I couldn't have things the way I wanted it. They had a voice and they had an opinion, and you know, obviously you have to compromise on some things. So yeah, there are definitely some benefits, and there's also some things you have to compromise on, and kind of now I think I have a better idea of how to plan for those things in advance next time. Absolutely.
Citizens of Earth, it's very earthboundy. You had this open world where there's a lot of unique, cool stuff hidden in the corners. You've spoken a little bit about the difficulties. You've spoken about having a publisher. What were just like the really joyful, awesome parts of making games? Because a lot of discussion swirls around like the indie apocalypse and the saturation of Steam. But to be honest, you wouldn't be here if you didn't still enjoy and love it.
I mean, yeah, like I think, you know, in a sense, I feel that almost every day. Like, again, it's hard to feel it, you know, when you're working 100 hours a week, you know, really slamming your head up against a deadline. But aside from those moments, I love it. And just like, I mean, especially in Citizens of Earth, I mean, seeing this idea I had of regular people are the heroes. I mean, that was sort of the seed of the whole game, right? Just regular people are the heroes.
So you've got a black, almost mad scientist. You got a teacher, a wheelchair-bound superhero. Like, you've got people from pretty much every walk of life.
And yeah, just like, just seeing that come to life. And I think, you know, a lot of it is due to the artist Robin Carpenter, who, you know, did all the, you know, character designs and everything, and, you know, just bringing that to life was just so cool to see. Just kind of see the germ of an idea that was in my head years and years prior just come to life is, I mean, there's no way to describe it. It's an amazing feeling just kind of see your, you know, creation, your ideas just, you know, realize it and come to life. And Citizens of Earth has definitely had a lot of those moments of just, you know, seeing, yeah, years of design and ideas just, you know, come to life and being playable. And
how long was Citizens of Earth in development?
The start of it is an interesting, sort of a nebulous start, because while I was working on Waveform, I was finishing up Waveform, and a friend of mine who I worked with at Silicon Knights, his name is Andrew Hockulik, he always kind of wanted to help me make games, but contractually wasn't able to, right? He was still at Silicon Knights and things like that. But when I was finishing Waveform, he said, okay, I'm whatever, I finished the contract, I don't have a job now, I want to help you make games. And I said, well, I'm basically done Waveform, there's nothing left to do. And he said, well, again, he's like, hey, remember that old RPG you made back in like 2006 or whatever that I already referenced? Why don't I work on that? Because we both love RPGs. And I was like, okay, sure, that sounds interesting. So he was actually working on that for, I don't know, 6-8 months, something like that. And just sort of core technology. Because if you look at the difference, Waveform is a very different game than Citizens of Earth. Citizens of Earth is massive in comparison in not only like scope, but, you know, just all the tech we needed to build it. So he was working on sort of that core technology, you know, getting it started. And at this time, like, I had already, I mean, I had the idea of Citizens of Earth, but that wasn't really what he was working on, what we were working towards. And it wasn't until, so Waveform was out, and I was sort of helping him work on, I guess, that game, or just, I mean, I say that game, it was really mostly like core RPG technology. Yeah, that's right, engine work, right? Rather than a specific game. But then, like, later on that year, so like late, I guess, I don't know, August, September 2012 type thing, we were sort of just talking with other, you know, people, artists and things like that, and say, you know, what kind of game do you want to make? And it was sort of unanimously decided, like, people just like this idea of regular people being the heroes. And at the time, it wasn't called Citizens of Earth. It didn't really have a name. Actually, the working title of it was Starbound, just in reference to Earthbound. But, I mean, I don't know if you know, but a lot of projects have, or in the games industry, have, like, code names, right?
Yeah.
That they're referred to during the development. So, yeah, Starbound was sort of ours, I guess. And, yeah, so then, like I said, it's kind of had a murky start, I guess, in terms of, like, well, what exactly are we working on? Like, wasn't really Citizens of Earth. But then, yeah, right around kind of that point, fall, kind of summer 2012, we're like, okay, yeah, let's start and make what would eventually become Citizens of Earth. So it basically started there. ended, I mean, basically started 2015, so it's about 2.5 years. And, I mean, I was working on it essentially full-time. No one else was working on it full-time for that whole stretch. You know, people would kind of come and go based on their sort of schedule and other things. Sometimes, you know, part-time, full-time for a time and things like that. But I guess, yeah, sort of 2.5 years is probably a kind of good round number to explain the bulk of the development.
2.5 years, Citizens of Earth is released. People can get it on Steam, PlayStation 4, Vita, Wii U, 3DS. Waveform is also available on Steam. What's next for you? And what do you hope, at least, for your future projects along with Citizens of Earth?
Well, yeah, so right now we're working on quite a number of prototypes and projects, just kind of seeing, you know, I don't know, just, yeah, kind of feeling it out, like, just seeing what's going to stick as sort of the next project we're going to work on. You know, we're sort of talking to some publishers and, you know, seeing what they like and what we're interested in. But one of the really fun things is, like, again, you know, when I started Waveform, I literally had nothing. I had to build everything from scratch. When I started Citizens of Earth, I mean, I had a little bit from Waveform, but still had to build so much from scratch. But now we have so much stuff. Like, any prototype I start, I have so much code I can reuse, and I can make it run on, like, any platform I want instantly now, essentially, because it's reusing our own engine, which is a really cool place to be now. So finally, I have, like, a really strong framework to make cross-platform games with, like, you know, a good big scope. And that's great. So now, you know, I have, I don't know what it is now, four prototypes kind of running on all those platforms, and just, like I said, kind of developing them, seeing where things go, you know, talking with the team and publishers. So, yeah, we've definitely got a lot of kind of buns in the oven, as it were, and just, yeah, we'll see which one kind of sticks as our next project. Yeah, definitely with Citizens of Earth, I mean, I did absolutely want to get across, like, hey, you know what, like, everyone, yeah, I said everyone is special, whether you're, yeah, like a little girl in a wheelchair or an old man, right, or whatever race, doesn't matter, like, you're, you know, valuable and special. And like you said, it's not, I'm not hitting people over the head with, like, here's a Bible verse, right? But again, I think it's just that sort of sense of, yeah, the things I believe in coming across in a sort of practical, but, I don't know, just, I'm not trying to, like, hide anything or be, you know, subliminal messaging about it, but just create an environment, an atmosphere that reflects the things I believe in. You know, people often ask me, like, oh, well, what do you think is the most important thing as a Christian game developer? And the answer I always give is make fun games. Because if you don't make fun games, people will see you as insincere. And they will not, you know, they won't respect you as a developer or as a Christian because you're too heavy-handed in your approach, right? And most Bible-based games are like this. Like, they just bash people in the heads with Bible verses, and it's not a fun experience. Spiritual Warfare is basically a Zelda clone at its core, but surprisingly good one. Like, they really got the formula right, which is surprising. Even, I'd say, better than a lot of, like, non-religious Zelda clones, of which there are many. But basically, you walk around a world, and there are, like, people. You play like an angel, but in human. Like, you look like a human, but I guess you're supposed to be an angel or something. And, you know, people are running around, and they're kind of ruffians, and they're, you know, muggers and thieves and things like that. And you throw Fruit of the Spirit at them, and they, like, wow. And they, like, so, like, it's kind of like you're kind of shooting, right? So, like, you shoot, like, the pear comes out of you, or the pomegranate, or whatever. And if he hits them, you know, they'll, like, repent. And that's how, they don't die, right? They repent and whatever. But, like, it was a fun game. Like I said, I've gone back and played it, I mean, it was a couple of years ago now, but I'm like, this is still fun. And I think that was, for me, like, a really great example of a Christian game done right. Like, man, they were a little heavy-handed at times. Like, you know, you walk into a building and an angel would just spew a verse at you. But at the same time, like I said, it was a fun game. It was, like, it was worth your money. You paid whatever it was, and you got a good experience out of it. And still had, you know, like, you learned things. Like, I learned what the Fruit of the Spirit was as a kid, right? I mean, so, yeah, I think it was a fun game. It, I don't know. And I think that was first and foremost what was important. And still, you know, managed to get across some interesting ideas.
So your advice for those who are also of faith who would like to start developing games would be just to make a fun game and allow your faith to express itself naturally rather than forcing it.
Absolutely. And I mean, personally, I mean, let me get up on my soapbox here. Like, I think that's the biblical approach, right? Like, I mean, you know, even, you know, Paul says in the Bible, like, you know, become all things to all people, like in the sense of like you need to fit in. Like you can't expect to just, you know, scream Bible verses at people. Like you know what I mean? Like that's not how you reach people. It's not how you share what you believe in. And so, you know, like, I think also the sense in the Bible of like, you know, whatever you are good at, whatever God has gifted you with, do it to the best of your ability, right? If you're a carpenter, build things to glorify God. If you're a musician, if you're an artist, if you, you know what I mean? No matter what you are, do that thing well. And that's how people, you know, people will appreciate that and respect that. And I think if you come into games and just say, well, I'm going to make a bad game to tell people Bible verses and that'll glorify God, I personally don't believe that's true. Because you're showing that, like, these gifts God has given you or whatever, you're using them in a very sloppy manner, an insincere manner. And I think, you know, using God's gifts to the best of your ability glorifies God. And, yeah, sort of being, you know, the kind of person that people can respect is important. Like, in the video game industry, there are not a lot of Christians. But just by working with them and having people see me as the person they respect, I and many people I've worked with have a new perspective on Christianity and on my faith in today's kind of culture. Like that's a thing people really, they can kind of see through phoniness, you know what I mean? And they appreciate someone they can respect. And that's how people will come to appreciate, you know, your faith and your religious views is, you know, first you need to show that you're, I guess, worthy of being listened to in a sense, that you're worthy of that relationship, right? I don't know. That's the way I kind of look at it. And that's why I think first make sure people don't think you're a phony in terms of like making games, because then no matter what you say, they're going to think it's phony.
All right, so final words, don't be a phony, live your faith, make fun games, and please, 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 for the love of God, buy Eden Industries games.
Yeah, that all sounds very on target.
Anything else you'd like to say or a little nugget of wisdom you'd like to deliver before we finish?
Yeah, I mean, I think like just, I don't know, just kind of riff off what you were just saying. I mean,
Please, for the love of God, buy your game, that part.
That's that part, but, you know, I mean, I think, again, going back to, like, the subject of, like, you know, Christianity and game development, I mean, there are still a lot of Christians today, or churches, or whatever, that would think, they would sort of vilify games, right?
Yeah.
And again, and this is why I think, you know, so it's funny, because Christian game developers are gamers, in a sense, and sometimes you kind of get hit from both sides, because other Christians will tell you that it's bad, or wrong, or whatever. And non-Christians will, which are the majority in that industry, will look down on you. And so that's why I think it's all the more important to really just stay strong in your faith and yeah, be an example of that faith to both sides, really. So
Ryan Vandendick, Eden Industries, Citizens of Earth, available in a number of places, going to have the links and all that lovely stuff in the description below. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for supporting. And many thanks to you, Ryan, for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
This has been Nelson for Video Games and Bible.